This is Fresh Air. When Martin Scorsese read Richard Price's screenplay for Mad Dog and Glory, Scorsese said it was time that Price saw one of his screenplays made into a film that reflected what he'd actually written. That encouraged Price to become the executive producer of the movie. Price is happy with Mad Dog and Glory, even though the studio insisted on a happier ending than the one he had in mind. Scorsese is one of the producers of the film. They worked together before on The Color of Money and New York Stories. Price also wrote the screenplay for The Sea of Love and is now adapting his recent novel Clockers. Mad Dog and Glory continues Price's investigation into cops and killers. Robert De Niro stars as a mild-mannered police forensic photographer named Wayne, who inadvertently saves the life of a small-time gangster and bad stand-up comic, Frank, played by Bill Murray. To say thanks, Murray gives De Niro a present, a human present, a beautiful young woman played by Uma Thurman, who works at Murray's club. De Niro gets to keep her for a week. Of course, De Niro falls in love with her and doesn't want to hand her back over to the gangster.
The origin of the story was I was in Jamaica in the late 70s, and I hooked up with this Jamaican busboy at some hotel in Montego Bay, and he found out I had a car, and he said, oh, no, we got to go into the interior. We got to see my grandfather. I'll show you the island, you know, and get away from all these tourists. I said, fine. He shows up the next day, and he's got this blonde, lanky woman with him in a two-piece bathing suit, and her name is Dawn Rosenblum, and they're together, and I can't figure out what these two people are doing together. And I spent the whole day in a car with this guy and this girl, and they weren't talking to each other. I don't know. I couldn't figure it out. I thought, well, maybe she's one of these people who likes to go down, you know, and get down with the locals or something. I had no idea. But the day after that, I wound up on an airplane going back to Miami with her. And I asked her, I said, oh, is he your boyfriend? She says, no, well, you know, my friend Frank was down in Jamaica, you know, from Miami, and he went into the water too soon after eating, and he got a cramp, and this guy here jumped in and saved him. And when Frank came back from Miami, he said to me, well, baby, how would you like a trip down to Jamaica? You can do me a favor, won't you? And next thing I know, I'm standing by the Quonset huts behind this hotel where all the help lives, and knocking on the guy's door in a two-piece bathing suit with a sash that says, thanks, Frank. And, you know, she was like this human thank you present. And the story stayed with me. I don't know what this woman did, you know, when she's not in Jamaica. I don't know what her story was. I don't know who, quote-unquote, Frank from Miami is, but it sounds like if he's the type of guy who can get somebody like this to do him a favor like this, it's like, you know, yikes. And it just stayed with me for about 10 years before I figured out, you know, how to dramatize this triangle.
It's really funny that this premise of the human thank you present was actually something you found in real life. I thought, well, this is Richard Price really creating a very movie idea.
Well, no, actually, I mean, this is so politically offensive. I mean, I would never do it unless it, you know, it was
right.
Sometimes
right.
They say that, I think Norman Mailer once said that the defense of the bad writer is that something really happened, you know. But the fact of the matter is, it really happened. It just stayed with me. My mind doesn't work this way to make up things like this. You know, mm-hmm. I'm too paranoid.
So the Bill Murray character is the character that you mentioned, Frank from Miami,
yeah. Whoever Frank from Miami might be. And, you know, once you got a character, you're going to say, all right, now how can I make this guy different than every other, you know, silk-suited golem we've ever seen, you know, in Crime Story and Miami Vice? And, you know, how do I make him not Tony Bentnose? And, you know, so I put him in therapy. You know, I made him a bad comedian. You know, you just try to find things, you know, a la Bill Forsyth or something. You know, I mean, you know, just take it someplace where it's never gone before, but not in a way that anybody's going to get a hernia over your inventiveness because it seems so inserted.
I love the idea of putting him in therapy because he's really trying to be sensitive now, and he really wants to be friends with the Robert De Niro character. And it's this gangster twist on the whole male sensitivo cliche.
Yeah, well, there was a scene that's been edited out of the movie because it was too long, in which he explains his relationship to his therapist, in which he says, my therapist is a degenerate gambler, and she's into me, you know, for God knows how much money. She can't pay it, so I take it out in sessions. I have three sessions a week, and, you know, she's in the hole for me for all these trips to Atlantic City.
Now, the Robert De Niro character is a cop who's a forensic photographer, and he takes pictures of bodies and crime scenes. He's not a tough guy. You've been hanging around with cops for a long time for your research for the film Sea of Love, for which you wrote the screenplay, for your novel Clockers, which is about cops and teenagers selling crack. Did you, in your years of hanging out with cops, meet anyone like the character De Niro plays, you know, a forensics guy who isn't a tough guy?
Cops are kind of like people, you know, which is to say that there's thousands, they're legion, you know, and some guys are going to be psychopaths and some guys are going to be fascists, you know, and other guys are going to be, you know, social workers, you know, and you know, bleeding hearts, believe it or not. I mean, you know, I don't particularly like or dislike cops. I mean, what I like is what you're allowed to see when you're with the cops. Because on one level, it's got to be the greatest show on earth. I mean, you're going to every situation in human experience in which mediation instantly is needed. I mean, you see human behavior in such extremists, you know, and that can really become addicting. As far as any cop that's kind of like Wayne, that's kind of like passive, is more like a photography buff than a hunter. Well, I hung out with the crime scene unit, the New York City crime scene unit, which are the forensic cops. Anytime there's a murder, they'll go to the scene, and what they have to do is preserve the scene. They'll bag the evidence, they'll photograph the body, they'll itemize the wounds, they'll lift the prints. Basically, they're not the hunters. They don't go after the bad guys. Well, basically, what they're doing is memorializing the death scene. And that's a strange type of cop job. Now, most of these guys are on the other side of the 50-yard line in their career. You know, and it's kind of a sedentary type of job. You sit around waiting for the phone to ring, which means that the beast chewed up another one, and you got to pick up your, you know, your forensics kit, your death kit, and, you know, hot-foot it out to Brooklyn or Staten Island or wherever. And it's a strange type of job because it doesn't seem like they get affected by it because they've been doing it so long. Sort of like being a doctor or a nurse in an emergency room in an inner-city hospital. I mean, you're seeing so much bloodshed constantly that the only way you can function is to sort of, you know, be numb. I mean, you know, if you sob and cry over every wounded child or every dead body, it's like you can't function. And it's not normal to see as much death as they do and get that, you know, blatantly emotional about it. It's anything can become routine. And it just fascinated me.
Now, you wanted to make Bill Murray into a gangster that wasn't your standard movie gangster. I'm sure you wanted to do the same with the cop part of the movie. There's been so many crime films.
I wanted to make a movie where a cop movie in which there's not one shot fired. Well, there's two or three in this one, but basically I wanted with no shots fired and no car going over the speed limit and nothing bumping into anything else.
Well, in fact, you know, there's one scene that's very funny. Bill Murray's bodyguard and De Niro's partner are fighting, and they're about to crash into a glass window. And one of them warns the other, "Uh-oh, it's a window. We'd better move away." And you know, if this had been Lethal Weapon, it would have been a great special effects shot.
Well,
they'd crash through the window and fall to the floor.
I'm not interested in that type of writing. I mean, it's like I'm trying to make a career out of giving people what they don't want, you know. all innovation starts out as a bad mistake, you know. It's like I'm in this business in which, you know, people want Count Chocula and they're trying to give him Count Chocula and Frankenberry is considered bold, you know, and I'm trying to give him granola, you know, or, I don't know, grape nuts. But, you know, it's like I'm in this, it's sort of like a tightrope that I'm doing. It's that I'm trying to write this stuff that you're not supposed to make on a studio level, but if I can do it good enough, maybe they'll do it anyhow.
De Niro plays the cop. I understand he had his choice of playing either the gangster or the cop.
Yeah, now originally Bob was going to play the, we call him Bob. Originally, De Niro was going to play the gangster, and, you know, Scorsese was in on the casting, too. He was the other producer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just a reflex. Oh, you know, we got to get Bob for this. And we had a reading down at the Tribeca Film Center, and he got a whole bunch of actors, and we just sort of did a cold reading of the script. And we did it twice, first with Bob playing Frank, the mafia guy, and then we did it with Bob playing Wayne, the mild-mannered cop. And I think he felt at the end of the reading that, why should I play Frank? Because I always play Frank, or it's expected of me to play Frank. You know, and like, you know, every other actor, he wants to quote-unquote stretch his instrument or whatever you call it. And, you know, he figured this would be more interesting, more of a challenge for him.
Mm. How did you cast Bill Murray?
That was Bob's choice. I didn't think of him. I didn't know who we were going to get. It seemed like it would be so easy to get somebody that's intimidating, you know, to... you know, there's so many, you know, good actors out there who can play scary, but you know, the hat trick, and so Bill Murray was not one of the guys I was thinking of. Not only was I not thinking of Bill Murray, but this guy had to be scary to Robert De Niro, Jake LaMotta, Travis Bickle, you know, Max Cady, and so it seemed like, God, can Bill Murray scare Bob De Niro? But he did. I mean, you know, Bob has a way of shrinking. Or expanding, or you know, making his body and his face, you know, do like changeling tricks. And Bill was a great actor; he was just terrific. And in real life, I mean, you know, in terms of size, I mean, he could eat apples off De Niro's head. I mean, he's a big guy. I mean, you don't know that, and he's got that Irish face. You know, he's got like this hard Irish face, these, you know, these cold eyes. You know, and that's not usually what he exploits in his roles. And, hey, everybody's stretching their instrument around here.
Mm-hmm. Richard Price is my guest, and he wrote the screenplay for the new movie Mad Dog and Glory. He's also the executive producer of the film. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Richard Price. We're talking about his new movie Mad Dog and Glory. And he also wrote the novel Clockers, the screenplay for Sea of Love, and wrote many other novels as well. A couple of your novels were made into movies by other people. You had nothing to do with the screenplay. The Wanderers and...
Right.
What was the other one?
Blood Brothers.
Yeah, The Wanderers, Blood Brothers. Then you wrote the screenplay for Sea of Love. Now you've got a screenplay that you're also the executive producer of the film. So what does it mean to be the executive producer on this one?
Well, you know, an executive producer is sort of like a vanity thing. I mean, you know, an executive producer is the ruler, like Queen Elizabeth is the ruler. You know, you get the hat and the check. And, you know, try to keep your family out of the tabloids. I mean, you know, now my power was more a veto power than any power to implement anything. Like if they would offer me like some director, I'd say, oh, no way, no way. And they go, oh, okay. But if I myself went to Universal and said, hey, fellas, there's this guy who made this independent movie, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. It's probably the most horrifying thing I've ever seen. And I would like him to fly this $18 million Universal finance plane. I think they would have looked at me and they said, you're a writer. Shut up, you know. But I had Marty with me. I mean, after a year, I couldn't get anybody in there. I needed, you know, to have somebody with a little more firepower than myself to sort of second me or me second them in order for Universal to go along with it. And John McNaughton was really Marty Scorsese's find. And, you know, between me and Marty going to Casey Silver, who is sort of president of Universal, and saying, look, this guy's good. He's an independent guy. He's not some Hollywood hack. But I don't know if I would have had the power myself to go to Universal and say, hire this guy who did this thing about a serial killer to do a love story.
So you had to screen Mad Dog and Glory in front of test audiences, right?
Yeah, all pictures. And, you know, I mean, studios are basically enthralled to this into this focus group thing where basically they're asking people, what do you want? What do you like? Do you like it like this? Does this make you unhappy? What makes you unhappy? What can we do for you? How can you tell us how to make this to make the maximal amount of people happy? You know, and it's a business because it's so expensive to make any movie on a studio level that they can't take a chance on something that, I mean, they want everything that they could possibly do to make the maximal number of people coming out of the sixplexes happy enough to say to their friends, oh boy, you should see that picture. And it's a business. The danger of doing something that's original with a studio is they don't care how good this original thing is. The fact is we do not have any financial precedence for this type of what's it, ungenrefiable picture. If we felt that this picture was the child of Fatal Attraction and Sea of Love, we are very happy. But we don't know who the financial parents of this type of picture is. We don't know what's going to happen. we could be writing a $20 million check that's going to fall down a bottomless hole. You know, we don't know. We don't have any kind of track record on this type of picture because we don't even know what type this is. And it's too much money. It's too scary. So then originality becomes the ending. It becomes the enemy.
When you were watching the test audience file into the movie theater, were you thinking, oh, no, not him. Oh, gosh, not her. She's not the kind of person who'd like my movie.
Well, you know, that's the funny thing. It's, you know, it's like that's the dilemma of being an artist. You sort of, you know, on some level, you're obsessed with, you know, people liking what you do and all this praise and, well, people like this and how many people, I wonder what the reviews are going to say and are people smiling, are people laughing? But you don't know any of these people. It's completely anonymous and it's completely irrelevant, you know, to what's important in your life on a day-to-day basis. You know, they're not your family. You know, they're not your friends. They're just this sort of anonymous American public. So, yeah, you look at all these people and say, oh, look what that guy's wearing. I mean, the last time I wore stuff like that, I was a junior in high school, and I looked dorky even then. It's like, I didn't even know they made that color combination anymore. It's like, oh, God, look at that guy's haircut. What does he think he is, Metallica? I mean, it's like, oh, man. It's like, get these people out of here. I don't care about these people. You know, but these are the people. You know, I mean, it's very, you know, in an artist's mind, the public is very impersonal. It's just this one giant hand coming down to either slap or caress you. And then when you see the people, you know, it's like, who are these people to me? I don't know them. I don't dress like that. My hair's not like that. So eat that stuff. I don't take that crap into the theater. You know, you know what that's going to do to your blood level, your blood sugar or whatever? You know.
Did you learn anything that you were glad you learned?
About what?
From the test groups, from the focus groups.
Well, yeah, but not from the scores and the numbers. I mean, you know, you're in the crowd, and it's sort of like you're bobbing on an ocean, and you know when you're in a dip, and you know when you're in a wave. And when the original cut, there was a fight between De Niro and Bill Murray, and what I intended was De Niro was not even going to land a blow. I mean, the way it was originally written, this guy, he's no match for the mafia guy in a fight. And what I wanted and what they shot was basically De Niro getting his ass kicked terribly, but refusing to go down, refusing to go away, until this Bill Murray character becomes so demoralized that hitting this guy, who he really wanted as a friend, and he's so enraged at this guy because he's getting this beating for a dumb girl, you know, and this guy wants this girl so much more than he wants Bill Murray's friendship that he'll take any kind of beating in the world if it's going to win this girl's freedom from Bill Murray. And, you know, at some point, Bill Murray just can't hit this guy anymore. And then he realizes, you know, the depth of commitment that De Niro has. He's been jilted. This guy, De Niro, really wants this girl more than he wants Bill Murray's friendship. The problem with the fight was you can't have Bob De Niro in a fight not landing a punch, getting his head kicked in, and then all of a sudden Bill Murray just stops fighting because the decision to stop fighting was kind of internal. I mean, it's easy to write it, but, you know, you got to dramatize and physicalize and verbalize all this stuff. You know, and basically what you have on the screen is a guy getting his head kicked in, and then all of a sudden the other guy just stops. He puts his hands down. He says, I don't care, and he walks away. And people in the audience went, what? What the hell did he stop fighting for? A, why didn't De Niro fight better, which is, not, you know, not my problem originally. And B, we don't understand why Bill Murray stopped hitting him. Why did Bill Murray stop the fight? Why did he say keep the girl? I mean, it turned out I could see it was not working dramatically and visually. People were not understanding why Bill Murray would stop hitting this guy. It was so perversely anticlimactic.
So did that make you think, gosh, this audience just isn't hip enough or smart enough to get it, or did that make you think I didn't do a good enough job in projecting the reason?
Well, it's not their fault. It was my fault because what you have to perpetually learn as a screenwriter, that what plays beautifully on the page is not necessarily what's going to play beautifully on the screen. What's great dialogue on a page, it's not about the written word. It's about the spoken word. It's not about the written stage direction. It's about the acted stage direction. And what I realized is that what I was asking of the actors and the director in, you know, was to externalize a deeply and climactic internal moment. And it just couldn't be done, you know, and it was sort of my fault.
So, having been screenwriter and executive producer on Mad Dog and Glory, are you ready to jump back in and do another film? Was this experience, or?
It was a rough experience. But I'm real happy with the movie. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm finishing up the script for Clockers, which I'm doing with Marty Scorsese.
So he's directing it?
Nothing signed on the dotted line or anything, but, nothing ever is. Nothing's for sure until the film's in the can.
Boy, you're going to give yourself a cameo in Clockers? Which is about crack dealers and cops?
Of course.
Do you know what part you'd like to have?
I'll probably play like a white customer. They usually give me these
from the suburbs or something.
They usually give me these cameos where I play like a human stain. I had a great cameo in Mad Dog and Glory. I played that cop when De Niro's dancing around a cadaver in a restaurant.
What's it like for you to see yourself larger than life on screen, especially in a film with great actors?
It's 10 times worse. Well, do you know what it's like when you hear your voice on a tape recorder?
And
you're kind of like grossed out and horrified. Yeah. Well, it's 10 times worse because it's your whole body in addition to your voice and your face, if you want to call it a face.
But it doesn't scare you enough to stop yourself from doing it again?
The funny thing about movies, it's so addicting. It's one time I ran into this novelist who had just written the screen version of his own novel, Who Shall Remain Nameless or Rename Nameless. And he was like a quivering. He was like this human fist. He was so enraged and traumatized by the experience. He was cursing out the director. He said he knew if he put in two extra lines for this actress, he could sleep with her. And he just used my script as, like Spanish Fly. And was like, he just walked all over me. And was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And I was thinking about writing screenplays back in the 70s. And I listened to this guy. I said, oh, God, I'm never going to do screenplays. And this guy, he just went on like the Ancient Mariner about what they did to him. And I said, oh, my God, so what are you doing? He goes, well, I'm writing another script. That's what it is.
Well, I look forward to
your
next
movie. It's like that Woody Allen joke, my brother's chicken, I'll cure him. No, we need the eggs.
We need the eggs, yeah. Well, hey, good luck with the next film.
Okay, thanks. Send me some Valium.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Okay.
Richard Price is the executive producer and screenwriter of the film Mad Dog and Glory. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.